All right, well, we were dealing with the different doctrinal issues as they developed. You know how we have a system of doctrines that we see in the Bible pretty clear. But if you just start off reading the Bible without any background at all, you wouldn't necessarily come to our system of doctrines right away. I mean, you would make assumptions about what it's talking about, and it would not be clear. In fact, take just something like the prophecies or the parables. You know, how do they apply? If you read, say, Martin Luther's take on some of the parables, you realize the man just did not understand what they were about, or the typology in the Old Testament. We know the types are there in the Old Testament because Paul talks about them. Hagar means the Old Covenant and Sarah is the New Covenant, and, you know, makes it very clear there are allegories. But how about all those stories in the Old Testament? How do they apply? And then all the prophecies, the direct prophecies, how do they apply? A whole lot of people misunderstood what was going on. For example, there were a whole bunch of prophecies about the Messiah coming. But there was a confusion about whether this Messiah was going to be a conquering king or whether he was going to be a suffering servant. Because we had, and so a lot of people just assumed that the suffering servant wasn't the Messiah. That the Messiah was the king. He was going to come and conquer. And yet we find in the first coming of Christ, he was the suffering servant. Isaiah 53 and 55. And Zechariah, you know, the sheep are scattered. And this is the suffering servant prophecy. But nobody really applied that to the first coming. They were thinking that the Messiah was going to come and establish his kingdom. So when he was called the Messiah, well, then people understood, but they understood wrong. They thought that he was going to come and reign. And then he kept on saying things like, my kingdom's not from here right now. The kingdom of God cometh not with observation, which is exactly what the Old Testament does not say. The Old Testament says clearly it's going to come with observation. And Jesus, when he foretells his second coming, he says, every eye is going to see me. I mean, it's going to be like lightning from one end of the other, heaven to the other. Don't believe anybody when they say he's over here secretly, which is a very interesting thought for the Jehovah's Witnesses. And if you ever have a conversation with Jehovah's Witnesses, you can just ask them, well, you know, you say Jesus came in 1914 secretly, but doesn't Jesus say right there in Matthew 24 that don't believe anybody if they say he came secretly? He says when he comes, everybody's going to know. Everybody's going to see. And many prophecies in the Old Testament said everybody is going to know. They shall all know me. They shall all be taught of God. Nobody's going to ask, show us the Lord. They're all going to know me. He's going to be there, and he's going to be clearly visible to everybody.
Is that at the point where the rapture's already happened? When, well, this is for the whole unsaved earth, when Jesus comes back to claim?
It's called the Advent. When Jesus comes back again, we call that the Advent. That's when he establishes his kingdom on earth. He comes to live and reign on earth.
But the rapture's already happened.
We assume because of the way things line up, when you try to put them together in an event-oriented setup, we assume that the rapture's already taken place. And the reason why is because there are two sides of the rapture that to get them both to be true, you have to have the rapture happen early. In other words, it's a secret and it happens as a surprise, which can't be if he comes and everybody sees him. And there's a several differences. They call it about the imminence and the surprise factor, and come as a thief in the night. Nobody's going to know about it. These are surprising things. But what I'm trying to get to is that we are building upon the knowledge and structure that Bible students, people who really know the Bible, have studied and put together for thousands of years now. And so we can look at it from a certain structural point of view and say, for example, we're dispensationalists, and our dispensationalism allows us to understand the prophecies, you know, how they could be separated by a couple of thousand years and yet still be part of the same prophecy. This is a structure that they did not understand in the first 100 or so years. After Jesus told about the end of the times and all that stuff, and it was all written down, and everybody starts studying these things, what do you think they expected? When Jesus says, I'm going to come again, and I'm going to come again soon, What were they expecting? They were expecting him to come again and come again soon. They expected it even in their lifetime. It appears that the apostles even at times expected it within their lifetime. In fact, Jesus made a statement to one of the apostles that, or to all the apostles, he said, there's some of you standing here which will not taste of death until you have seen the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. So when you look at those verses, you think, you would assume, all right, the time of his coming is soon. Now what happens then after all the apostles die, all the scriptures are put out there, everybody starts studying them, they start reading these things, and he says, there are some of you standing here that shall not taste of death. How do you apply that? You can see how Christians would become a little bit confused about things. Well, a whole lot of them thought, well, okay, he's delayed it. He's you know, had to postpone it for his reasons or whatever. And they have these kind of ideas. But a fellow named Origen, and it might have been Clement, or even before him, we don't know, but somebody started teaching in the North Africa, Alexandria. They started teaching that he was speaking spiritually, that Christ's kingdom is a spiritual kingdom, not an earthly kingdom, never was an earthly kingdom, and established what's known as now supersessionism. And supersessionism is the idea that the church has taken the place of Israel as the church. And everything that was said to Israel has its fulfillment in a spiritual sense in the church. Now this happened in North Africa, that whole region of Christianity. It started spreading, and there was disputes about it in other places, but it started spreading, and by the time of Augustine, Clement was like the year 200, Origen was around the year 250, and Augustine, year 350, 380, something like that. Augustine wrote the book called The City of God. And in it, he basically explains all of these New Testament doctrines, all of these New Testament things, according to this spiritualization concept. So that there are two cities. There's the earthly city, and then there's the heavenly city. And, of course, if you know the scriptures, you can see where they're coming up with this stuff. They're making a sincere attempt to try to understand the scriptures, and they know it's got to be true. It just doesn't make sense from a literal standpoint. And so, for years, people did not understand, you know, what church history was about, how it was going to happen. They were expecting, you know how many Christians went to their death gladly expecting to be raised again within a few years? The first couple of hundred years of Christianity, most Christians were expecting Christ to come back any minute now and reign for 1,000 years. This was the doctrinal setup called chiliasm. And that's the same thing as millennialism. That's the idea that Christ is going to reign 1,000 years because of what it says in Revelation. Christ is going to reign 1,000 years on earth. Chiliasm means 1,000 years. And millennialism means 1,000 years. So one's Greek and one's Latin. So anyway, they were millenarians. Almost all Christians were millenarians the first couple hundred years. Almost all of them. But then you got Origen and all of them. They start saying, okay, forget that. It's all spiritual. And then they all just completely revamp it and turn it in. They just deny that the 1,000 years is literal. They assume that the reign of Christ is in our hearts. And he comes when he came at Pentecost. That's how he came. And so that basically answers a lot of their questions. How did Christ come? How did Christ say that some of you will not taste of death? Well, he came at Pentecost. And then all the stuff that was prophesied in Revelation about the, you know, everything going to happen so badly, well, they just made spiritual applications to the war in Judea, the year 70, when Israel was destroyed and a whole lot of bad things happened to Israel. And then all the persecutions happened and all that stuff. And so they just assign that, all those bad things that happened in Revelation, to something that had happened in the past. And then they assign it, in a sense, ongoing as like the book of Revelation is a prophecy of how the church keeps on going, waiting for its fulfillment of its mission. The idea of the mission is that the church is going to fill the earth. The church is going to keep on dominating, keep on growing until it fills the earth. And eventually, sometime in the long future, the earth will be completely filled with the gospel, and God will establish his spiritual reign. It's a complicated mess of the scriptures called amillennialism. And it's still probably the number one interpretation of the Bible. Roman Catholicism, Greek Orthodox, and most Protestants. Episcopalians and Lutherans, they're all millennialists. Even evangelical Christians such as Baptists and Presbyterians, evangelicals like Congregationalists, and they're all millennialists. They do not believe in a literal thousand-year reign. We are of a literalist interpretation called millenarianism. We believe in a literal thousand-year reign. This causes us certain problems with certain verses, like the one I mentioned. Some of you will be alive when I come back in my kingdom. Well, how do we understand that? Well, Jesus then, right after that, he appears in the Mount of Transfiguration, and that's his glory. And so three of them went up with him and saw him in his glory. And Peter says that we saw that when we were with him on the mount, we saw the glory of his coming. That's in 1 Peter. So we assume that's what he was talking about. Well, how about where he says, this generation shall not pass away until all of these things be fulfilled, which everybody understood. The people who are alive right now will not all die until everything I told you about in Matthew 24 has happened. Well, how do we explain that? Well, we think it means the generation that sees the fig tree blossom will not pass away until all these things be fulfilled. But you can see how we're making an application based on our structure of how we understand the Bible. Somebody will say, well, that's just new doctrine. And for many, many years, it would be considered new doctrine because most people didn't believe that. But the first couple of hundred years, all Christians believed it. They believed in a millennial reign going to happen soon. And the reason why I say this is because the church developed its doctrine built up over years and years of years. And what happens, the way it happens is people come up with an idea, like Origen did, came up with an idea, and Augustine took it farther, and then we try to see where that doctrine took us. And what that doctrine did was it caused the church to become militaristic, became political. It started trying to have power over the kings because they took all those prophecies about Christ's millennial reign and gave them to the church. And all those prophecies in the Old Testament about the Christ going to reign on earth, it gave them to the church so that now the Pope is reigning as the substitute of Christ on earth. And what it caused was, it caused a militaristic church with armies and conquest, and it wasn't about faith, it was about forcing people to submit, and it completely changed the character of what the church is. So that historically, the church, because of a misunderstanding and a sincere attempt, but historically they messed themselves up. In fact, they messed up a whole lot of things. They started trying to force everybody into the same. They wanted the church to have this dominance over the earth. They thought that was God's will. So they would have wars in between the Greek and the Latin. And then they would have wars against all of these dissident groups like the Novatians or the Montanists or these others. They would have wars to bring them into line. And by the year 800 to 1000, they pretty much had conquered all of Western Europe. And the Eastern had conquered nearly all of the Eastern side, so that we were left with just two major churches.
Who was doing the conquering? The Catholic Church?
The Roman Catholic and the Greek Orthodox. They were trying to consolidate to make this one kingdom that God had prophesied. But that's a misunderstanding of the scriptures. We look at it very literal. Jesus said he's going to come back and reign. But that's what we believe. He's going to come back and reign. Now, how all these verses match, we don't know. Maybe we can understand them now. Maybe we don't. Who cares? We accept what we can understand literally. He's going to come back and reign. But you can see then how the doctrine kept on evolving, kept on switching and changing. And it had a problem, and some people would say, this is what it is, and somebody else would say, no, and they would have these arguments. Then what happens when you get down as late as, say, John Wycliffe, who saw all this corruption, and he goes back and reads the scriptures and says, this is not right. Or all these Waldenses, or these Albigenses, or these Paulicians, or these Montanists, or these others, Nestorians, who lasted for many, many years, they were saying, no, we don't agree with that idea. We don't believe that. Well, they were persecuted, and they were spread over all of Christendom. They were spread all over, hiding, and they weren't part of the main church. So nowadays we have the argument of whether the Catholic Church was ever a real church, and I personally believe it was. I believe the Catholic Church, the Greek Orthodox Church, and all of these dissident churches were and still do form part of God's real church, because the real church are the true Christians among all of these dissident groups. And the reason I say that, because this is almost heresy in some people's mind, because they'll say the Catholic Church is the evil empire, basically. It's the mystery Babylon. It's the scarlet woman on the beast, you know, and it's the Antichrist and all that stuff. Well, the Bible is very clear about what the Antichrist is. The Antichrist is someone who denies that Jesus Christ came in the flesh. And that's not the Catholic Church. They believe he came in the flesh. They have all kinds of horrible things. And there is a mystery Babylon mixed in with the church. But remember what we saw. The church never was going to be pure. Jesus said it's going to be contaminated. He said there's going to be demons in the branches of it. He said there's going to be false doctrines and false. There's going to be apostasies happening. And several of them. So we do not have to try to trace the true church like the Baptists and the Seventh-day Adventists do, try to trace their true church, basically a roots program, where they go down and find, and I've got the list of all those, you know, they find the list that came from this. They try to prove that John Wycliffe actually got his doctrine from a fellow named Lollard, because they were called Lollards, and this Lollard came from Bavaria, and that comes from the Waldenses, and the Waldenses come from the Cathari that were in the north of Italy. Those came from the Vigilantians, which were the ones that were attacked by Jerome, and they came from, and they just keep going back until they can finally prove it. Some of them are so crazy, they actually try to prove that they were all baptized by somebody who was baptized by somebody who was baptized by John the Baptist. That's just way overboard. We know that the church is all of us, or actually it's the ones God knows within the whole of Christendom. There are some Catholics who are Christians. There are some Lutherans who are Christians. I even think there's some Jehovah's Witnesses who are Christians, and that's a real stretch.
Yeah.
That's a real stretch. But the reason why I say that is because I have to realize God is the one who knows their hearts. And God is the one who knows where they stand and what they're trusting in and whether they've been born again. God knows. Is it possible for a Mormon to be born again? I have to say, God knows. God has to know. He's the one who knows. I haven't met any that I thought were, but who knows? Now, the reason I say that is because I don't want to get into this idea that, you know, the church history is all... these little persecuted groups, because these persecuted groups also had errors. You deal with a Baptist brider who insists that Baptists have been Baptists since forever, since John the Baptist, and of course they're just not even being reasonable. They were never called Baptists. There was like 30 or 40 different groups that were called Anabaptists simply because they would rebaptize adults. They did not believe in infant baptism. And that's one of the other things that comes out of these arguments. The reason why I'm going to this is to let you know there has been an evolution of doctrine among Christians. And so if we were somehow to be transported back and start talking to some of the original Christians, say in the year 100, start talking to Polycarp or somebody like that, and we start explaining the way we understand the Bible, they would think we're crazy. I'd say, no, that can't be. They would think we were unbelievers. And we would say, you guys are a bunch of heretics. So when you read church history, you'll find that every single group had errors. At least I do. And I don't mean, you know, innocence errors, as in they hadn't studied it out. I mean they had come to wrong conclusions. For example, you'll have a group that refuses the priesthood, refuses the celibacy. They refuse to bow down to images. They are very openly against this hierarchical system. They're openly against the Bishop of Rome. They're openly against all of these corruptions. But they baptize babies. Well, are they real Christians or not? Now, see, if we get so stuck on, well, we're going to follow our line back, and you're going to find out every single group was wrong on something. Take Waldenses. The Waldenses they believed in a transubstantiated mass. They believed in the Eucharist. They believed in that junk, you know. You look at the Cathari. They believed in a dualistic system, almost an adoptionism, or the Albigenses. These were all fighting against infant baptism. They were fighting against the Pope. They believed the Bible, whatever, but say they believed in baptismal regeneration. Hey, you're not going to get any group that's pure. And from our standpoint, I would say the church right now is as pure as it has ever been. Taking everybody into consideration. Lump us all together. Catholics, Protestants, all of us together. Christianity as a whole understands the Bible better now and believes the Bible more than at any time in history since the apostles died. Now you say, well, no, it's getting worse and worse. Actually, it's really not. The truth is, there was such a division, such a strong division over so many issues before the Reformation. Now, the Roman Catholic Church insists, no, we were all one. And then the schism that Luther caused. This is simply not true. There was so much division before the Reformation, and afterwards there was a whole bunch of consolidation of all these. For example, there were the Waldenses. They existed since, they don't even know how old, but at least since the year 1000, and they existed as a separate group, persecuted at times, but a separate group all the way up until the Reformation, when they joined the Reformed churches.
Are they still called that today?
Waldenses? Well, they joined the Reformed churches. Now they'd be called Presbyterians.
Oh, the
Presbyterians are Reformed. The Waldenses, well, these are the Baptist writers are real strong on the Waldenses. The Waldenses, they're our forebears. But you know, they were celibate. They were weird. They had their own problems. Talking about, you know, they had the pure Bible and they had the pure beliefs and all that. They were Baptists. They weren't even Baptists. They were, you know, they did rebaptize. They did not baptize babies, and they did rebaptize adults when they got saved. And so they were Christians in some sense, but all kinds of things they were wrong on. So what I look at the whole of Christianity, and I see all of these, man, in Cyprian's day, everybody was confused. They were all confused. For example, they were confused. There were so many Christians confused on the Trinity. If you read the Church Fathers before the Council of Nice, that's the year 325. The Council of Nice was to settle the Trinity once and for all. So before they settled the Trinity in the Council of Nice, so then you had the Orthodox and the Unorthodox party. You had the Nicene Christians and the Arian Christians. Before that, anybody you read, you're going to think that they were heretics. Because you have people believing in adoptionism and dualism and docetism and Arianism and patripassionism, Sabellianism, all of these things that are not Trinitarian doctrine. And they do not believe in the three in one. They were all arguing over that statement, these three are one. Which, by the way, none of the new Bibles have. None of the new Bibles have the statement that they all were arguing about. These three are one. If you go back and read all these old fathers, they're constantly quoting the three are one. The three are one. That's where the word Trinity comes from. They're all quoting the scriptures as the three are one. And what modern versions will have us think is that that phrase didn't get put into the Bible until, you know, the year 500 or so. And it came in from the margin or whatever. Well, then what were they all arguing about? The 3R1. Some of them say, well, the 3R1, they're really one, they're not really three. Or they're really three and they're not really one. But this was a huge argument over the Trinity. Now, what goes on then, if you have all these people before the Nicene Creed tells us that that there are both three, and that they came down with the idea that it's a mystery. They are three, absolutely three, and yet they are absolutely one. And we cannot explain it, but basically we're not going to get rid of the mystery. All of the what later was called heresy were ones that got rid of the mystery. They would say they're just one. They're not really three. That's the Sabellian. The Sabellian say they're not really three. It's just a mirage. It's just a way of understanding it. They appear different, but they really are one. It was the Father himself that came to earth and was crucified on the cross. And we've got people in our church to this day that will say that's the way it is. There's just only one person. There's not really three. The three is a figment of our imagination. You see, I don't believe that. I believe that they are three and that they are one. But I'm not going to get into that argument right now. What I want to show is that there was a time when you asked any Christian on earth, what do you believe about the Trinity? And they would come back with a heretical answer from our standpoint now. Arius, he came down with the idea, look, Christ was a man that was divine in his efforts or whatever, but he had divine qualities, or he was special. That's basically what the Jehovah's Witnesses believe nowadays. And at that time, you think, well, where are they getting this? They're just reading the Bible, and very clearly he was a man. He very clearly says things about him that. And so they're trying to understand, but they're just overlooking other verses. Then you've got those Sabellians that Tertullian argued against so strongly. One of the reasons why a lot of them would not quote the whole 1 John 5:7 says there are three that bear record in heaven, the Father, the Word, and the Holy Ghost, and these three are one. All of them quote the these three are one. But some of the Bibles, in fact the Greek Vulgate, is missing that whole phrase where it says Father, Word, and Holy Ghost. Even though all of the people would quote that whole phrase. So, I mean, they would quote that last phrase, that last part of the phrase. So we know it was there, but there was an argument over what the actual scriptures were supposed to say. And the Latin church kept that, the three or one verse, and the Greek church lost it. Deleted her. Who knows how that happened? But that was one of the big arguments between the two churches, is that the Latin Bible had that 1 John 5:7, and the Greek Bible did not have it. And so when they consolidated in the Reformation, they left it out, the first edition or a couple editions, and there was such an outcry that they put it back in. So,
well, did they throw out the verse that says, where Christ says, no man cometh unto the Father except by me? Because he's saying there's a Father and here I am, and you're not going to get there till you come through me.
Well,
doesn't that show
even more
God in the flesh?
Even more clear than that is the next verse where he says, "How he says, show us the Father and it sufficeth us. And Jesus says, how long have I been with you,
yeah,
Philip? He that has seen me has seen the Father. No, all of those verses were in the Bible and they were all arguing about it. Everybody, they were arguing about it for interminably until finally this council of bishops said, this is what we have to go with. We're going to go with the mystery doctrine of the Trinity. They are three and one. We don't know how that works, but that's what we believe. And anybody who rejected that Trinitarian formula, that they are three and one at the same time. In fact, they call it co-equal, one in essence, not one in just purpose, or not one in just. They had all these other arguments about how they were one, and they came down saying, no, they are really one in essence. They are of the same substance. but that they are also three separate in eternity or whatever. Okay, this is the Trinitarian doctrine, but it wasn't immediate. Paul did not explain it this way, and neither did Polycarp or these early Ignatius or whatever. One thing we do know, I got it written down a couple of them. For example, there is no doubt that the New Testament conflates Christ and God, and that's in all the Bibles at all times in history. You can find that the New Testament clearly treats Christ as God over and over. It calls him God. Every Bible, even the newest New World Translation of the Jehovah's Witnesses, where they've actually tried to cut out every reference to that fact, I can still show it to them in there. It's clear. It's impossible to get rid of completely. So there's that. That's clear. Another thing is, a fellow named Ignatius died in the year 117. He clearly worshipped Christ as God. It's written right in there. He died in the year 117, so he was contemporary with the apostles, and he outspokenly worshipped Christ as God. Pliny the Younger, who died in the year 112, observes Christians, he says, they sing to Christ as to God, saying they worship God. He was not even a Christian. Lucian of Samosata died 180. He wrote this: he was second only to that one whom they still worship today, the man in Palestine who was crucified because he brought this new form of initiation of the world. Now, the reason why I say that is because it was so clear that Christ was God that some people denied that they were three. And that's the reason why people like Tertullian won't quote 1 John 5:7, even if it's in his Bible. We know it's in his Bible because he quotes the last part: these three are one. But the problem that they had using it to quote on the Trinity was because there were no Arians, there were no Jehovah's Witnesses back in those days. Everybody knew Christ was God. They just didn't know how much of God he was. They had the argument over whether he had become God, or whether he was always God, whether the Father was the one who died on the cross. And Tertullian argued against the idea that the Father had died on the cross, that they were really three. And so there's this argument up for the first couple hundred years, and only later did the argument come out that Jesus wasn't God at all. He was just a created being. That was Arius and a couple of others. Anyway, on all of this you have the Gnostics. The Gnostics were they had Hellenized, they made it into a Greek form of worship, and that's way too complicated to get into right now, but the Gnostics were one of the biggest. They flourished from about the year 80 to the year 250. They had the Logos confusion. For some reason, John the Apostle used the word Logos to introduce Jesus in his gospel. It says, in the beginning was the Word, and he used the word Logos. Logos was a very common name for the manifestation of deity back in the ancient Greeks. And so when he used the word Logos, he knew what he was doing, but what that did was that it was trying to explain the gospel to Greeks, to the Greek rational thinking. And it did. And so a whole bunch of Greeks got wind of it, and they started their own little Christian movement called Gnostics or Gnosticism. And all these people were really confused. If you read any of their literature, you'll see what I'm talking about. They were really confused. It's like they were on drugs. You can't understand anything they're saying. But anyway, the second one came out with Sabellianism. That's where Christ is the Father. And they did not believe in a threeness. The third one was Arianism. That lasted in the East. The West got rid of it, but from about the year 250 to about the year 600, Arianism was really strong in the East. And you'll notice that the Eastern Bible is the one that got rid of 1 John 5:7. And so there's reason to believe that there's some corruption going on. They were really a strong group for a long time, Arians. Anyway, where was I going with this? Okay, we have several other doctrines. Another one that came up was original sin. This is a big doctrine at the beginning. Original sin is what Paul says. We are condemned to die, not because of our own sins, but because of our father's sin, Adam. And what does this mean? You see, because you read that and you understand it, what it says, you know, that people died who hadn't even sinned. Why? Because they died because of their father's sin. Well, it said there in Romans 4 through 5 and 6, whatever, and in 1 Corinthians, that it's called original sin. We have been given sin both by our nature. It says we were made sinners, and it also says it was imputed to us. This idea of original sin caused certain problems. People started thinking, well, you know, what does that mean, that these babies are condemned to hell because, you know, they're born? What if a baby dies? They're condemned to hell. This caused a huge argument in the first 200 or 300 years. Huge argument, and that's where the doctrine of infant baptism comes from. Because some people say, well, it's just like circumcision. The way we keep our children from being condemned is we have them baptized and they become part of the covenant, and then they're what later on was called covenant theology, where if you have your child baptized, actually covenant theology comes through the Calvinistic side of it, where they believe some children are elect and some people aren't, some children aren't. But basically the idea was, if you'll baptize your baby, they won't go to hell. Now that's not in the Bible at all. But this was an attempt to try to get over this hurdle. This is a deep hurdle that kids, that babies are condemned before they do right or wrong. But the Bible says this very clearly, just distinctly says it outright. These babies are condemned to die by Adam's sin, not by their own sins. And if they die without salvation, without Christ, they die in a state of condemnation, which logically tells us they're going to go to hell. Now, most of us just don't believe that. Even if we don't have a scriptural answer for it, we just do not believe that God's going to send a baby to hell. It just doesn't make sense to us. So it just depends on how you're going to answer this, how you're going to come. And there have been so many arguments over infant baptism and over what and how these babies don't go to hell. The truth is, every time I find the doctrine of hell, it's always about works, never about imputation. I don't find anywhere where it talks about people in hell and being judged according to their father's sin. That's not, it's never called. It always says they shall be judged according to their works. So I do not believe that there's any suffering babies in hell just because of what hell is described as. But I can also say that, you know, babies that die before reaching an age to believe in Jesus, that they go to heaven. But the Bible doesn't say that. But anyway, this was a huge argument back in the beginning. And this is what caused what they call pedobaptism, where they start baptizing babies. And most mainstream churches baptize babies. And it gives them a sense of, look, we've got this baby safe, it's taken care of. The problem is that people start trusting in that baptism as if that's gotten them good with God, and they never go any farther.
Yeah, for life.
Yeah, it's bad.
I baptized when I was a baby. I'm going to heaven no matter what I do. You know, like that.
You had the two sides. You had the Pelagians that did not believe in original sin. They just basically upright denied what Paul says in Romans 5. They do not believe it. And there's a bunch of anti-Calvinists today that reject the idea of original sin, no matter what the Bible says. I can't do that. I can't just make those verses mean nothing. I have to apply them. But that's called Pelagianism. And basically they say everybody gets what they choose. If you choose to sin, then you're choosing hell. If you choose to accept Jesus, then you're choosing heaven. And so they just do not believe that there's any choice made. That's Pelagians. Then you have the semi-Pelagians, which were in between all of it. They were in between the Augustinian infant baptizing covenant theology type thing and this Pelagianism, where it's basically a work salvation. You get whatever you choose. They have these semi-Pelagians. And just about every Christian that I know is a semi-Pelagian of a sort, one way or another, because they're just in between. They're not, they don't go all the way on one side, they don't go all the way on the other side. We're just kind of like floating around here in between, not sure, you know, how to apply it all. But that's another doctrine that developed. I mean, it wasn't immediate. People had to read the Bible and say, well, what? How do you apply this? How do we, you know? I thought that was a tough one. How about the idea of redemption? If you just read the Bible, what, where do you come, you know? Take the judgment. If you just read the Bible, you start thinking, okay, there's a judgment. Many times the Bible talks about a judgment. But have you ever noticed that sometimes the judgment is there a throne, they bring the nations, and you know, there's some like sheep and goats and whatever. And then sometimes the judgment is, it's, you know, it's up in heaven, it's not in the, there's different settings for the judgment. Now how would you explain all these differences? Well now, after many years of structured studying of the Bible, we know that there are at least four different judgments. At least four. Some people count 7, 8, 9, you know, however many. I count four very clear, distinct judgments. We can say really clearly there's one clear different one, is the one, the judgment seat of Christ, which is for Christians. And that happens before the marriage of the Lamb. So that's before the millennial reign. And the other is the great white throne, which is after the end of the millennial reign. So there's two different judgments right there. And then we have the judgment of the living, the ones that survived the tribulation, which is the sheep and the goats. And then you have the judgment of Israel, where he says that that he's going to take his elect and separate them out. And anyway, but you can see how from the very beginning, all these people just reading the Bible, they're trying to put this stuff together. And they say, well, how do we apply this judgment? And so they come up with all kinds of strange ideas of purgatory and you know, how to get past this judgment and different levels of judgment, as in, you know, outer darkness. And how they applied this thing was very strange. If you look down at all those different groups throughout history, they had some really strange ideas about the day of judgment. We're much clearer now than we ever have been on judgment. And what about salvation? Find people who talk about receiving Jesus into your heart before the Reformation. Almost, in fact, find anybody who talks about the new birth before George Whitefield. What happened? The church, its understanding of the scriptures evolved. They see things, they're building on somebody else. Now, these people were saved. They were born again. They did accept Jesus Christ as their Savior. They made these decisions. They converted to Christ. They just didn't understand it in our words, in our terminology. So if you go back and look in the year 1200, St. Thomas Aquinas, and read what he has to say, you'll think, my goodness, this guy cannot possibly know Christ. These people are lost. But not only you don't understand, nobody talked about salvation in those terms back then. You have to judge these groups by their own light that they had. And so, in my sense, we now understand salvation better than the church did throughout history. If you look at it like this, you see how God is desarrollando. He's developing not just the church in its going out geographically, he's developing the doctrines in our minds, letting us build on the structure of people who really knew the Bible, and they just lay it out for us so that it's in order, and we can just keep building on that and understand. And if we didn't have that, we'd be just as confused as all them back there. So the church throughout history has been divided, severely divided, and only unified by force. And even then, never truly unified. And now that it's completely free, and the Reformation did that, completely freed everybody to follow their own conscience. Even Catholics are following their own conscience now. Because the freedom, it's just really hard to suppress once you've seen it, once you've got it. That's the reason why, by the way, in case you're not sure about it, that's the reason why the fundamentalist Muslims are blowing people up. because they cannot compete with the freedom that our modern world has given their people. And the same way with communism. Communism cannot keep, they cannot keep Chinese from searching on Google. They can't. You know, the idea of controlling the media, it's over. You can't do it anymore. And so what's going to happen? They're going to have civil wars. Why? Because people can get their information out there. And what are they going to do? What are the Chinese going to do? Take away all their computers? Those are some of the most technologically savvy people in the world, the Chinese and the Japanese and all those people. You cannot keep the knowledge from them. So this world is getting freer and freer. And of course, I think it's going to become more and more prosperous, but it's going to become more and more wicked. Because prosperity allows us to be who we want to be. And that makes us more, that's why wickedness shall abound. But anyway, in the way the church grew, the church used to be terribly divided, but now look at the church. If you look at Vatican II. If you study Vatican II, the Catholic Church changed. I mean, it really changed. I realize there's some things that are still really horrible in the Catholic Church. And there's a whole bunch of Catholics who are still very held on to their old Catholic dogma. But the truth is, there's an awful lot of similarities between what they're saying now in the Catholic Church and what evangelical churches are saying. And Protestants, do you realize that millenarian Christian kind of disappeared in a great way around the year 300? There might have been some vestiges of it up as late as 400, but I don't think so. It was just about gone and didn't come back until the Puritans in the 1600s when they started taking the Bible literally again. And this is millenarian Christian. The church was so confused about the prophecy of Christ coming again, and yet now almost all of Christianity, even the ones that are amillennial, they don't believe in it, but they still act on its assumptions. If you'll see, the Roman Catholic Church acts on the assumptions of millenarian doctrine, that Jesus is going to come back and reign on earth. They don't even realize it, but they're assimilating it right now, simply because we have the freedom to preach it. And we are preaching it effectively, even if it's by these money-hungry television preachers. Whatever it is, they're getting this doctrine, they're hearing it. I remember hearing, you remember that movie that came out, I guess it was in the 70s, called The Omen, or something of that nature. It was a scary movie or whatever. But it was all about the Antichrist and all that stuff. Have you noticed how many movies there are about the Antichrist and Armageddon? You hear them, they're all talking about Armageddon. Mel Gibson wrote this thing called the Apocalypse, you know, and they all have these things. So they're all using our doctrinal presuppositions. People like Hal Lindsey changed the world. Completely changed the world by dispensational premillennial doctrine. And now all of Christianity is taking this in. They're just soaking it up. We are actually becoming one in some way or another right in front of our eyes. I don't know what God's going to do, but it's happening.
The late, great planet Earth.
That was Hal Lindsey.
That was a wild...
Back in the 70s.
Yeah, really. Like, whoa.
Another one that they had a real problem with was the sacraments. Because Jesus said, do this. And Jesus said, this is my body. And so somebody said, well, you know, this is taking over from Passover or whatever. So they just tried to apply it, and they got the idea that this is actually his body, and that this is... And they got their ideas not just from the Bible, but also from their own pagan backgrounds. And so they're trying to apply it the best they know how. They got all confused, and they think that the Mass is the actual Eucharistic Mass where it really turns into... And they didn't even understand that at first. If you read... Back in the year 400 or 500, they didn't understand transubstantiation. They didn't understand that the elements become the body in some way, you know, as you're eating it. You know. They didn't understand that. That was Council of Trent stuff, you know. But how to explain it? You know, the Lutherans say consubstantiation, and somebody else says some other thing. All this stuff was such a difficulty for the church to understand until finally we saw so many errors in so many of their ways that we finally just say, scrap all of that. He was speaking metaphorically. And that's where we are now. And we also talk about the confession, and that was so that became gradually what it is now in the Catholic Church. It wasn't that way immediately, but it developed and it became such a source of corruption to this day. You know, all these priests that are being sued, and the Catholic Church sued and all that, because the priests are celibate and they hear this confession. I read that book, The Priest, the Woman, and the Confessional by Chinicky, years ago. And so when I was in Mexico, we had a bunch of friends that were not Christians. They were just friends. It was before I married Debbie. It was Cindy and me. And I asked some of these ladies, I said, you were Catholic. Did you ever confess? Yes. As a young girl, you confessed? Yes. Did the priest ever ask you leading questions, sexual questions? Yes, it was so embarrassing. Like what? Exactly what it said in that book. Asking them questions and I asked them, why do you think he was asking those questions? She said, if you want to, this was more than one woman, many, many women have told me this. If you want to know what I think he was trying to get himself excited or get me excited, trying to seduce me. And this is what happens. And this is such a source of corruption. And so, after the Protestant Reformation, when we had the freedom to just take the Bible and apply it how best we could see fit, we scrapped it, got rid of it, junk it, it's no good. In fact, they talk every year, the Catholic Church talks about getting rid of celibacy. It's just that corrupted. And you got the old groups that won't do it, and you got the European Union Catholics, and you got the North American, that's America, U.S. and Canada. They are fighting to get rid of the celibacy requirement. In fact, in England, it's not required. Celibacy is not required for Catholics because they have the Puseyism, which is the Anglicans moving back, or they're trying to get the Anglicans to join the Catholic Church again, and the only way they can do that is if they get their priests to join the Catholic Church, and the only way they can do that is they could keep their wives. And so in England, there are Catholic bishops and Catholic priests that are married. So you can see how the doctrine has just taken this big tumbling turn in the whole of Christendom, and it's coming back to a more biblical base, very slowly, but it is happening. And of course, then you have the church government fiasco, which how does the church govern? And at first, it was just, in fact, if you read the early writers, the early church fathers, they all talk about plural bishops, plural pastors in every congregation, just like it talks in the Bible. But after about 100 years, it degenerated down into a one-man bishopric. And then in another 100 years, there's several layers. There's a bishopric per church. There's a bishop over the city. Then there's priests, and then there's deacons, and then there's higher-ups, archbishops, and then cardinals, and it just keeps on growing, this hierarchical system, top-down, military rank type system. Well, most of the dissenting groups didn't have that junk, but the Waldenses did. poor Baptist briars. But, you know, some people you just can't teach. You can't help them out at all. But anyway, the Puritans, it started with John Calvin, the best I can find, and I have studied it to try to find where John Calvin got it. I traced it back as far as John Calvin. I knew the Puritans had it, but they got it from John Calvin. I can't find it before John Calvin, where they believe in a democratic church government, where it is the church elects their own bishop. And he got it from just like all the Puritans, based it on Acts chapter 14, verse 23, where it says that Barnabas and Paul went back through all the cities and appointed elders in every church. Well, that word appointed, the word in Greek means stretched out the hand, which they thought meant raised their hand and voted on. But that would mean Paul and Barnabas voted on. It's a completely misreading of it, but they got the idea that that meant election. So all of these Puritan and the groups that came out of them, basically most Protestants, they believe in democratic church government, which means the church gets together and votes on who their pastor is, which turns it all into a hireling ministry, which is not biblical, simply not biblical. All of the Puritan translations, including the Genevan and all those older ones, even Tyndale's, all of them, these were all Puritan-based. They all put in election in that verse. Mistranslated. It was bad. The King James put it back. King James went back and made it right. Said it says appointed. It's not elected. It doesn't even make sense to say it was elected because it would have been Paul and Barnabas elected, you know, and that would be unanimous or, you know, divided because you can't have an election between two people. Anyway, that was a real problem. And then, of course, you had the Presbyterian system. I mean, I'm serious. They were trying to fix this hierarchical system where these bishops ran everything and were accountable to no one except a couple of higher-ups. And so all of these different Protestant groups are coming up with their own ideas. And so you got the Presbyterian ideas and the congregational ideas, and Baptists went with the congregational ideas where it's all election. Until Darby finally says, hey, this is not how it was in the Scriptures, and goes back and reads the Scriptures and sees how they did it in the Scriptures. And Darby started the Plymouth Brethren movement, which is basically where we got our understanding of how things should be done. And it's very, very scriptural, very biblical. Every elder is raised up in their own congregation, and there should be more than one per congregation. And there are people that were there doing the work already, and they were recognized by the ones that were already elders. Very, very scriptural. But of course, not very many churches do it that way. And of course, what I've already talked about, the idea of millennialism and supersessionism and dispensationalism. And it's almost been an hour. Anybody got any questions on that?
It's just interesting how things seem to go in cycles and they just kind of get away. And it's not like they stopped reading the word, they just had a different interpretation of it and went with it until things were...
So many different interpretations. That's what amazes me. So many different ways of trying to figure it out. Until it dead ends. They take it their way. They insist on it. They're willing to die for it. They preach against everybody that doesn't do it their way. Until it dead ends into a horrible mess. Mm-hmm. And we pick up the pieces and we try to rearrange them. And then we say, this is what... And what we have now is rich. It's just... It's an actual practical application of the Bible. Believing what it says. Built around a structure that has been developing for 2,000 years.
So with the understanding that we have today of the Bible, like our church, for instance, how do you take a church like, for instance, Joel Osteen, that doesn't preach the Word, wrote his own Bible, I haven't even looked at it, but I know he's got one out, because they make money. But how do these men, using him as an example only, because there's others out there like him, and radio is full of them, how do they... in all consciousness do this when they have the Word and just bypass it like
you
that?
You do realize they don't read the Bible.
I think they don't.
They do not read the Bible. I have talked to these people. I've talked to the Christians that go to these churches, and I've talked to the people who are actually pastors. They don't read the Bible. They haven't finished it once. One guy is Jehovah's Witness that come. I've been dealing with him a lot of times. He's been a Jehovah's Witness elder for 12, 15 years, hasn't finished the Bible once. I just talked to a guy who's an associate pastor or whatever, still haven't finished the Bible once. They don't read the Bible. They're getting what they get from
whatever,
absorption somehow. They're absorbing it out of thin air.
Well, we've seen an interview one time on 60 Minutes where they interviewed him.
Joel Osteen?
Yeah, the interviewer says, well, how come you never talk much about Jesus and stuff in your message? And he says, well, I have a different type of a ministry. I'm more of an encourager, and that's what it is.
Yeah,
it's a kind of motivation, encourage, and like you bring something from inside yourself and lift yourself up by your bootstraps, so to speak, and make more money and give more money. And
well, there's going to be hell to pay. There's no doubt about it. If these people, if they're really saved. It was like Jim Baker. I don't remember if you ever saw his program before he got arrested. But it was also all of that. It was all that, you know, you see the healing and all the prosperity gospel and all that stuff. And he was such a fake. You remember that? And Tammy was such a fake. Oh, that's right. Jim and Tammy.
We watched the documentary on them, and
on her.
On both of them. Well, mostly on her.
Oh, she lost her mind. But yeah. He got arrested and basically got right with God. He got turned around, and now he's serving. He's already remarried. He's got his own little ministry over there where he's working with his new wife and helping homeless. And, you know, I don't know what it is exactly, but I've heard his testimony. And the man was saved all along. He said, no, I'm sorry, I was saved. I was just ignoring God and going against my conscience and doing what was wrong. And I was in sin, and I've repented. God's forgiven me, and now I'm way better off now than I ever was. And, of course, you know, he had 12 Rolls Royces that he was, you know, different colors.
For dog out.
Oh, ridiculous stuff. And he was using money that he was raising for a certain thing.
Yeah.
He was using it on his own.
He was building a retreat. That's
how he got caught for a federal fraud case. But anyway, there are a lot of them are saved. I think a lot of them are saved. They just, you get caught up.
Yeah,
just like we can get caught up in our little pet sin.
Oh, yeah.
And we defend ourselves and we hide it and we whatever until God finally breaks us and then we have to come clean. And sometimes, you know, he just lets us waller in our own mire, you know. But I think a lot of them are saved. I think
a lot of people got saved even though they went and crashed. But I just, you know, the ones that got saved, I just hope they're strong enough to keep going.
Well, look how many pitfalls there are nowadays. How many pitfalls there are for a Christian preacher to fall into? Every kind of error, whether it's a covetousness error or whether it's, you know, sexual. Oh, there's just so many ways for them to fall.
I read an article on Billy Graham that one of his rules was that none of the men were ever to be in a room with a woman counseling if the door wasn't open.
Yeah, we do that. I won't go into a house. If I'm there and it's a woman, I won't go into the house. We stand right on the porch.
Yeah.
They invited me in. I said, no, I can't come in.
Well, isn't it like, to me, it's like the way you described the early church and all the stuff that's happened, the way it's had to grow, and then like a Christian growing. If you keep reading the Bible, you keep growing at the same thing, the stupid stuff that you kind of thought, because you didn't know any better. Mm-hmm. But as long as you keep reading and hearing good preaching and teaching for people that are reading, and being around other people, it grows you up. It's like you're saying, we say the world's getting worse and worse. Yeah, you do feel like, it's like, okay, then you really see how sinful. Okay, yeah, I'm learning more, but yeah, boy, I'm still sinful.
Yep.
Right. Well, somebody pointed out at church the other night my tattoo. You know, they were talking about my tattoo.
Wasn't me.
But it's like, I was saved at an early age. I knew I was saved. I've been saved all my life, although I have Lord's over here, and I took off with that.
Sure.
Prodigal.
All of my sins
but
happened when I was saved.
When I did this, I didn't know it was in the Bible. So after I was made aware of it,
you realize that's in the old law.
Lord, forgive me.
It's in the old law, and you're not even under that law.
Exactly. But I put myself under the fact that, I mean, when I was at the flea market, one of the guys that had a tattoo shop out there wanted to trade a piece of jewelry, and he would recolor it for me with the new colors that will last. Knowing then, I'm not going there, you know, because today, and I know, even though you say it's under the old law,
I know, but
I wouldn't do it.
Right.
You know?
Well, you're allowing the law to teach your conscience what you're doing.
Well, I think you made a good point, too, though, about how the printing press made it readily available to everybody where for so many years, 1500 years, whatever, people didn't have the Bible. Whoever people were figuring these things out, like you said,
there was a lot fewer people that had access to the Bible. And before the printing press, 99% of people were illiterate. Couldn't read. Now this was different among the Jews. They taught Jews taught their kids how to read. They were one of the first literate societies were the Jews. And it's a huge difference. But most societies were 90% or better illiterate. They could not read if they wanted to.
You know, that's what they said it just on the news the other day. Water having so much trouble in Afghanistan, and they don't think their things are going to turn over the way they think. And one of the biggest reasons they said is because the men are illiterate. And they can't even read instruction manuals and stuff. Yeah. And that's freezing up major ongoing stuff.
Hopefully they read when to pull the pin out of the grenade.
So this 4 seconds or 4 minutes?
I think it's 4 minutes.
Oh, we got 4 minutes.
Yeah.
I think they're pretty good on those. I think they know all about them weapons. Well, no questions?
I don't know. I think this is it's very interesting to just see the cycle that's going, and you said a while ago, you think it's getting better. Of course, I know the world's getting more sinful, but based on what you said, I have to tend to agree with you that the Christianity is growing, even if it's like you got some churches that are
taking over the world.
Yeah.
And even right now, we think, the Muslims are no. Christianity is taking over the world as we speak. It's taking over China. It's even taking over the Middle East as we speak. Almost all of Africa is majority Christian. And all we lack is places like India and certain parts of Indonesia and then the Muslim areas. The rest of the world is dominated, at least dominated intellectually by Christianity.
I just saw an article the other day, though, that said that the slowest growing religion in the United States is no religion.
Atheism?
Yeah. I mean, you look at the kids today, college kids and stuff, they have no beliefs in nothing. I mean, it's like most of them.
I haven't met any of them. I've met a couple of them, but not very many. Most of them that I believe in, they're church going, they believe.
Well, I'm just saying as a whole based on what they're putting out.
I was over in Europe, and a whole bunch of people over there have a problem. They intellectually deal with atheism a lot. There's a lot of atheists in Europe. And they were asking me, how did you know there was a God? And I was trying to think. Something? It always seems so absurd to me that I've never even really considered the idea that there's no God. I mean, I've thought about it on an intellectual level, but to really consider it as a reality, I said, no, it's like a dead end. It's like you go down that road thinking for a little bit and you think, well, that can't be. It's just a dead end. Why even go down that road any farther?
Yeah.
Just a dark gray alley that you can't get out of. And they could not understand it. They are really intellectually disturbed by the proof that there is a God. And I'm thinking, what are you talking about? There has to be a God. Nothing makes sense if there's no God.
Could it be because they had so many... how did we get such a jump? Our parents were... Christians, not as good as they should have been, but we were always taught about that. When you've had a country with generation after generation, wasn't really not taught.
I know they're not
really
taught.
Foreign. Mm-hmm.
And all of the intellectuals belittle the idea of God.
Yeah.
They are what do you call it? Bold in their unbelief. Mm-hmm. And we got a bunch here that are bold in their unbelief, but the truth is, they just don't seem all that bright to us. At least not to me. I hear their argument. It just does not seem right to me.
One thing that you said cleared something up in my head. I never understood when you were talking at the very beginning about all the when people would get their beliefs and then they would go out and they weren't believing in they were believing that the millennium, I guess, was already taking place or whatever. In other words, they were sort of taking God's place. I don't remember how you said it, but. And they were making things happen the way that they thought it was going to be when Jesus came back.
Oh, okay, you're talking about like amillennialism, where they were taking those prophecies and trying to apply it. I don't remember how
and
I said
really,
it.
Yeah, I'm really forcing everything. That's what I've never understood, all these crusades and different stuff that people have done in the name of being saved and following God or whatever. that never made sense why they would do that. Nothing I could ever think of could make sense, but that makes sense.
It's the millennial reign. They believe we're in that the millennial reign is right now. We're living it.
And people would
Christ has to be on earth with a rock.
He is. He is on earth in us. That they think we are reigning right now on earth.
But didn't they say that they believe that he came in the Pentecost and that's already been 1,000 years?
A whole lot of people thought everything was going to end on the year 1000. That was a big, you know, the Y2K? There was a Y1K. They really? Thought, there was a huge, and for years and years before it happened, they thought the world was going to come to an end on the year 1000.
Well, Jehovah's Witnesses tried to nail it down a few times, too.
They messed up several times. And they finally got tired of changing, so they said, okay, he came. He's just here secretly.
Yeah. It kind of makes me, you know, one time you talked about the conspiracy, people that are conspirators or conspiracy theory people. Well, that makes me, when you were saying that, I wonder about those other people, how they're just, you know, taking up the thing and making all this happen or whatever. That makes me think of people who have a conspiracy theory. It's like they fit everything in and try to make this something happen that may not necessarily be happening. It's almost like they have the power to do, like, well, I guess they had whispers in their ear or whatever, that they know that this is what's happening and it's clear to them.
Well, why would all the people go down there with Jim Jones and drink the Kool-Aid?
Yeah. That does not make sense.
I mean, I watched a documentary on that the other day, and
those
people all over the place, their kids are dead.
1,000 people.
And
killed their own
why
kids.
Would they do that?
They gave it to their babies first.
Let them die first, and then they come.
All about that.
Well, why would those followers of David Koresh blow in their wives?
Yeah.
I'm thinking, the moment this spiritual leader says, hey, you want to loan me your wife, I'm saying, all right, now I know better. Yeah, it just all of a sudden opens my eyes. You're out of your mind.
It's already been corrupted, though. I mean,
they got to be really dumb. There's something really wrong with them.
Do you think it's deceived? Do you think it's possessed or
bewitched?
Or do you think turn over to their reprobate mind and they just kind of go with it and it's like...
I do not understand it. That does not make sense to me. I would immediately... Of course, I would distrust anybody anyway. If I heard somebody teaching about the gospel, whatever, I'd automatically think, okay, let's hear what you have to say. But even if I thought he really was, the moment he says, loan me your wife for tonight, all of a sudden all the mist disappears and I know exactly what this guy is. Mm-hmm. But they didn't. They didn't know. They sat there and loaned him his wife. Their wives. That doesn't make sense to me.
Well, I think, wasn't that the one that he actually was down in kind of like the San Francisco area? All the people that were looking for something? Mm-hmm. You know, the people in on drugs?
That was that Heaven's Gate one?
Something.
Oh, what's his name? Jim Manson. He was
Charles
Manson.
He had a weird thing like that, too. Yeah, he had a way of... they thought he was something.
Even when them girls were in jail...
They still were defending
him. They were still doing, putting this thing on, and they all shaved their heads and... Really crazy.
You know, there must be demons involved. There's got to be devils in there.
Jim Mason. We know that Jim Mason.
You know, out of the whole thing, though, right near towards the end, you know what struck me out of this whole thing? It's like probably guilty conscience, but we know so much of the Bible and its doctrines and the truth, and then I got a guilty feeling like, what am I doing with it? You know, I mean,
I think we're doing a lot with it.
But, you know,
it's not about how much effort; it's about what God has given us, and we can't help but do something with it. You cannot help, but. You know, be an evangelical Christian. It's just wherever you are. It's exuding. People see it. It's coming out of us. And it's not just us. It's all over. These people aren't even trying. But the doctrine is being spread out there. It's even in the movies and everything. But even these people who don't believe a thing about it, they can't help. I watched that show. What's the one with the guy with the patch? The guy with the... John Wayne movie had a patch on. Rooster Cogburn.
True Grit.
The new True Grit. If you haven't seen that,
no.
Through the whole thing, they're playing hymns. They're playing hymns all the way through it.
Wow.
Well, you know, you spoke about the Hollywood people and their movies and the apocalypse. It's like, they don't believe, but at the same time, they don't realize
it's captivating.
They're just kind of putting it out there, even in their worldly movies, you know?
And the first that you notice it is the Jews back in the 1800s. When all these Christians are saying, wow, man, you know, and they start believing the Bible literally, and they start telling the Jews, you're going to be going back to your land, and the Jews start, hey, that was the start of Zionism. Zionism did not start by Jews. Yeah. It was started by evangelical Christians saying, hey, this is what the Bible teaches, and the Jews had to learn it, because the Jews don't read the Bible.
Right.
If they read anything, they read the Talmud.
Yeah.
They don't know what the Bible teaches.
Yeah.
But the Christians who read the Bible started showing them. And then the Jews started the Zionism.
Okay, so isn't that like along the same thing of what you're saying, that they see something and they're going to do things to make that something happen? I mean, we read the Bible.
Yeah, but that is what the Bible said. The Bible said all along the Jews are going to go back to their land.
Right.
That God was going to take them back to their land. And so the fact that these Christians believed it, and they really did believe it, and they actually went and took over the promised land for that reason, and the Jews just were just ushered back in. You know, the Bible says that they're going to be carried there by the eagle's wing, and even it says about talking about the Gentiles are going to be carrying them on mules and all that stuff. Well, basically, that's what we did.
In 3 days, they became a nation.
3 days?
I think it was 3 days from the time that started back in, what, 46? When they went back over there and took over Palestine or that area. They became a nation like within 3 days?
No. They started moving back over there back in the late 1800s. Mm-hmm. And Britain took it over in 1917. Mm-hmm. And then 1947 was the War of Independence when Britain was moving out. And then in 1948 they were recognized by the UN. That was that.
There was a six-day war
in 1967 when the Jews took over Israel.
Oh,
I mean, took over Jerusalem.
We all say that word.
You were going to ask something, Liam? Now that your mouth is full?
I was just saying how you were saying that people were all confused with their doctrines back in the day when they didn't have a lot of literature. But now that we do know the Bible and we're the clearest we've ever been on our doctrine, there's still people who, like you said, don't believe in original sin, or people who are going back to the law and stuff. So, I mean, it has to
yes,
be
but as a conglomerate, as a group, as a whole, most all Christians believe in original sin. There's just no other way to, you know, to take Paul. I would say nearly 95-98% of Christians, Catholic, Protestant, everybody believes in original sin.
Well, they have a hard time. Well, I think the way Brian explained it when we were in the class was the imputation, that God imputed it to us whether we deserved it or not. It was imputed. He said it, and that's it. I can't argue with it. And a lot of people don't want to accept that. You know, where does he come off of, you know, doing me that way?
Well, it also is imputed the other way. Our sin is imputed to Adam. Because Paul says, the things that I would, I do not, and the things that I don't want to do, I do. So if I do what I would not, then it's not me that does it, but the sin that dwells in me. Paul is blaming Adam for his own sin. So it goes both ways. It's the idea that God just lumps us all together and says, you're condemned as a whole. But, you know, it's a complicated thing. And of course, it is a beautiful thing once you understand it and how it works out for our salvation. But they didn't understand that back then. I don't know. I see that God is involved in this history and He's doing it, and that it is working out really for the best. Things are becoming better. In other words, we should not have the idea that we're losing. We are winning. The true doctrine is winning all over the world right now.
We'll go to thought one time, and don't think I'm crazy just because I'm going to say it out loud, but I remember I thought it one time and it just came across my mind again. I was wondering, do you think maybe a baby doesn't have a soul until it breathes air? Do you think it already has a soul?
I do.
I mean, I just thought
that some people believe that it does not It does not have a living soul until it comes, until it's born.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I believe Peter Ruckman believes that. Mm-hmm. But
for that justification for abortion?
Yes.
Really?
That's,
oh,
that's
really?
Their argument.
Oh,
it's not a soul until it breathes. But then,
but the
we can actually.
God knew you before you were formed in the womb.
There's many verses that would
yeah.
disagree with that.
Right.
And we know scientifically that the babies had brain waves. Mm-hmm. In fact, they recorded a conversation between twins in the womb. No, I'm kidding.
One of the magazines called it checking out.
That's one of the checkout magazines at the counter.
Yeah, at the counter. That's what it requires.
Don't you have a spirit